Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network with me, Naomi Fowler. We've got a special extended TaxCast this month and we're looking at the crisis in Greece and asking what happened to the supposed European unity. So, no time for headlines this month, but I'm very happy to tell you one big piece of news that next month, the very first TaxCast in Spanish will be out, and I'll tell you more about that then. So, let's go to John Christensen now of the Tax Justice Network and hear his take on this month's Tax Justice news. Okay, John, we have some good news this month on the TaxCast. Despite all the upheavals with the Greek crisis, and we're going to talk about that later in the TaxCast, the European Union Parliament has actually voted for multinational corporations to publicly report financial information on a country-by-country basis. So reporting what they actually do in each country, where they have subsidiaries, so how many employees, how much profit in each location, how much revenue is generated and all that kind of thing. Quite useful information. So the EU's good for something.
Yep. So on the one hand, we've got the good news. This is good news for investors because investors will have much better information about what companies are doing in the different countries where they operate. It's good news for campaigners and investigating journalists because we'll be able to more accurately pinpoint where the profit shifting might be happening. This is a good transparency measure. Well done, the European Parliament. On the other hand, the European Commission, which is, of course, headed by the former Prime Minister of Tax Haven Luxembourg, Jean-Claude Juncker, the European Commission has yet again kicked the whole process into the long grass by saying they want to have yet another blinking study, probably done by private sector, people closely linked to big multinational companies, into how country-by-country reporting might be used and how it might be analysed. So we've got, on the one hand, the European Parliament voting, we want to move forward with this, and on the other hand, we've got Juncker and his cronies pushing for yet another delay. So it's a good news story in part. Let's watch this space to see how it happens. I think we at Tax Justice Network have something to celebrate here because we have been pushing for country-by-country reporting, which, of course, was initiated by Richard Murphy from Tax Research to begin with. We've been pushing this since 2004, and it's great that it's moving forward bit by bit, and it will one day become the international standard for reporting by multinational companies.
Whether they like it or not. And I'm just wondering how that might affect a country like Greece, which, as we know, is desperately in need of help in being able to track down its tax revenues that multinational corporations should be paying. I mean, if this country-by-country reporting did become law eventually, as we believe it will, how would that help Greece?
It is not the big fix, which will completely get rid of tax avoidance, but it will help the Greek tax inspectors to more accurately pinpoint those companies which need to have a thorough tax audit. So in that respect, this is a step towards tackling tax avoidance because it will become much harder for multinational companies to disguise the way in which they are using offshore subsidiaries to shift profits.
And I should say, on the point of European Union unity, which we haven't seen much of recently when it comes to Greece, we've got countries like the United Kingdom, which just announced it's going to cut its corporate tax rate to 18% by 2020. So that tells you a lot about European Union unity, I think.
Well, the United Kingdom government is running as hard as it can in this race to the bottom. But as Christine Lagarde of the IMF, International Monetary Fund leader, she recently said, this is a race to the bottom. And why on earth would any sensible country want to race to the bottom? This is a totally senseless measure. It's hard to understand how it can in any way help ordinary people or benefit the UK economy. But this is a government, sadly, of ideologues, and they think that low tax rates will stimulate economic activity, will stimulate investment. The end days of the mad ideas of Arthur Laffer, the American economist, who said that tax cuts will always stimulate activity. There's no evidence to that whatsoever of that happening. This is a lamentable step in the wrong direction for Britain and for Europe as a whole.
Okay. There's been an important meeting this month in Addis Ababa. We've had all the kind of big wigs, the heads of state, finance ministers, development people, NGOs, business sector, of course, all coming together there to discuss the United Nations post-2015 development plans. As TaxCast listeners know, the rulemaking is very much up to the wealthy nations in the world, and poorer countries have very little voice. Tell us a bit about what happened in this meeting. It's quite disappointing, isn't it? Apparently there was a lot of bullying going on in this three-day meeting of the poorer country governments.
Well, this is the third international conferencing on financing for development, a very high-level international summit. The financing for development process was launched in the last part of the last century, and one of its key measures is to help countries mobilise their own financial resources for their own development, domestic resource mobilisation. That's been the emphasis. Now, obviously, a part of domestic resource mobilisation is to put into place tax regimes which will raise money from local sources for investment in local services. But that's very hard when so much of the money is disappearing offshore through either tax avoidance or tax evasion or downright theft. So a key part of this process, right from the word go, was to tackle capital flight and tackle the tax avoidance thing. But to do that, we need a framework of global rules which will strengthen international cooperation and strengthen international transparency. And we've been arguing for many years that what's needed is a new global agency, an upgraded United Nations tax committee, upgraded to her political status, which will then have the power to set the rules and bring developing countries to the table, not just as people to sit there and nod and rubber stamp, but as people to set an agenda which suits all countries, not just the richest countries' needs. What's been happening for decades is that the OECD, the club of the richest countries in the world, have been setting the rules for taxing multinational companies, and they've been rigging those rules in the favour of their multinational companies. And the rules are rigged, there's no question about it, done deliberately and purposefully and knowingly. They all know that. What the non-OECD countries were pushing for at Addis Ababa this time round was for the creation of this United Nations political body to set the rules. And yet again, what we saw was the lamentable group of OECD countries led by the United States and the United Kingdom pushing back and saying, we will not allow this to happen, blocking the creation of a genuinely global intergovernmental body to set the rules for, amongst other things, taxing multinational companies. It's been going on for a long time, but you know, this isn't the only area where Britain and the United States and other very powerful countries use whatever measures it takes to ensure they get their way. It's an outrage it has happened, but at least many more people and NGOs and journalists are aware of it and are aware of the way in which the rich countries have been and are still rigging the rules in their favour.
So what next then? They didn't decide to empower this UN global tax body. What now?
Well, I think this is going to be one of those long campaigns which might take up to a decade to achieve, but I think it's going to happen eventually. Not only because the poorer countries are losing so much as a result, for example, of tax avoidance, and interestingly, the International Monetary Fund have now come out with a new figure, a new estimate of tax avoidance, and their figure is $200 billion every year of tax revenue lost to the poorer countries. But also the richer countries are losing huge sums. The same International Monetary Fund report came out with an estimate of tax losses to the richer countries, and that's $500 billion a year. So do the maths. 200 plus 500, $700 billion a year lost to tax avoidance. So those people out there who say it's not that big an issue are going to have to come to terms with the fact that the International Monetary Fund new estimate is $700 billion a year. That's serious cash by anyone's standards. So I think the pressure is going to mount not only in the poorer parts of the world, but in the richer parts of the world for a truly global United Nations-led rule-setting body. One of the kind of better announcements that came out of Addis Ababa was the announcement of a new United Nations Development Programme, OECD initiative called Tax Inspectors Without Borders. And let me begin by saying that this initiative came out of a Tax Justice Network recommendation to a conference organised by the German government in 2012. And we said one practical way of helping the poorer countries to tackle the problem of transfer mispricing, that is the mispricing of trade between subsidiaries of the same multinational company, an area where we know there's a great deal of profit shifting to tax havens, is to set up a new body, Tax Inspectors Without Borders, where some of the expertise of the really sophisticated tax inspectors in North America and Europe can be seconded for a short period to help the tax inspectors in some of the poorer countries work up a transfer pricing investigation, look at where transfer mispricing is happening, support them right the way through the process, if necessary, right up to the point where the company is prosecuted. But at every stage, there's a high degree of expertise required, and these are transferable skills. The idea is that tax inspectors from the north will help tax inspectors in the south to do the investigations, a very practical country-to-country way of helping some of the poorer countries overcome the highly sophisticated and really secretive transfer mispricing measures used by companies to loot the south. Great initiative, and I'm very glad that the United Nations Development Programme and the OECD are now cooperating to make it happen in practice. Our hope is that the very existence of an organisation called Tax Inspectors Without Borders, funded by some of the big funding agencies around the world, will act as a deterrent.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. It's been a terrible month for Greece and the European Union. The Greek people voted a decisive no, or in Greek, ohi, against more austerity measures being demanded by Greece's creditors and the Eurozone leaders. Yet they seem to have ended up with it anyway. This month, the TaxCast asks why that is and takes a look at Greece.
The only way out I outlined 4 or 5 years ago was for a debtor-led default and exit from the Eurozone.
Professor of International Politics and Economics from the University of East London, Vasilis Fouskas.
Simply because as the debt was transferred onto public institutions and people had to pay for that, people can pay only through extraordinary austerity, which was imposed, and we see the results on people, you know, 30% unemployment, 60% youth unemployment, soup kitchens around Greece, a European country. Salaries tend to converge now with Bosnian salaries, and you want to be part of the Europe like that? What's the significance of calling yourself member of the European Union? I can't see any point.
Almost no one believes the deal the Greek leaders just made with Greece's creditors and Eurozone states will solve anyone's problems, except maybe those of the banks who started all this mess. In many ways, the Greek crisis is a continuation of the government's bailouts of reckless lending by banks who lobbied governments so hard to relax the rules in the first place. The introduction of the currency of the euro presented a very lucrative business opportunity for northern European banks lending in southern Europe. And not only in southern Europe. Professor Vasilis Fouskas again.
Greece was in fact used as a launching pad in the late 90s and 2000 to financialize the Balkans with Greek banks. Greek banks only in name. The capital was German, Austrian, French, Dutch. So you could have Greek banks in the Balkans, in Turkey, in the Near East, in Egypt. They were not Greeks.
Why are they doing it through Greek banks?
Well, because it's so easy, because a Greek bank can go to the Serbian government, a Greek person can go to the Serbian government, they are in good terms, instead of having Germany, who after all participated in the coalition of willing in bombing Belgrade in 1999. So having Greeks penetrating the Balkans was great business for Europe and prepare the ground for the Balkans to integrate the region into the European Union. I mean, this is part of the expansion policy of the EU.
Let's talk about the source of the crisis. Where did this all begin, in your view?
This is a balance of payment crisis rather than a fiscal crisis. It has to do with the deficiencies of the Eurozone system as it stands and as it has been constructed, which is very rigid and monetarist. And it is dominated by the power that prevails in the European Union, which is Germany. And Germany imposes policy. And this policy is low wages, anti-inflation, budgetary discipline, and export-led growth. So all countries across the Eurozone must adopt that model. forgetting that not all countries are the same. Not all countries have the same level of development. What is good for Germany is not good for Greece or Spain or Portugal or Ireland, for that matter. It started with the global financial crisis in 2007-2008, which then it trickled down to the Eurozone via the banking sector. The first, actually, banks that experienced the crisis were German banks, and not many people know that. The German banks took the hit because they had bought many toxic products from the USA, like CDS, CDOs, and stuff like that, you know, futures, derivatives, and so on. And then this unraveled the contradictions in the Eurozone, especially in terms of the balance of payment structure of the Eurozone and the contradiction between the center and the periphery.
Okay, so tell me about the role of the German banks in the Greek crisis, because they lent irresponsibly, as did the French banks.
Yes, indeed, and also private lenders. I mean, we should not forget that the Greek debt was held by private investors and private banks, and what the previous Greek governments did irresponsibly and quite criminally, I would say, by signing two bailout agreements. These two bailout agreements transferred the debt from private banks and private holders onto public institutions. So now the institutions that are responsible for collecting the money are public institutions, and this is transferred, therefore, on the taxpayer. That's how the debt became a public debt and is now the responsibility of people of Greece to pay for that debt. That was criminal.
What would have happened to the banks if the debt had not been transferred to the public institutions?
It would have happened the same meltdown as it happened with the banks in Ireland and in Iceland. I mean, it would have been a proper banking crisis. It should have been a banking crisis, but this would jeopardize the existence of the Eurozone. It's very simple. It would have blown the entire system up. You know, but what they've done was clever, and what the Greek leaders did at the time was criminal.
And despite that, because those leaders were democratically elected, the so-called odious debt doctrine invoked by nations trying to release themselves from debt incurred by dictators probably doesn't apply here. Indeed, whatever the responsibility of past Greek leaders, they didn't sail their country down the river without plenty of help. Goldman Sachs, for example, may now be sued for helping Greece hide the real level of its debts when it joined the euro. Investigative journalist, economist, lawyer and Tax Justice Network senior advisor James Henry.
Private banks, in this case the German, Swiss and French banks, got over their heads in lending, making lousy loans, unproductive loans to Greece. From 2000 to 2007, they went wild with lending to the Greek government. Once they got Greece in the euro in 2001, for which they lobbied heavily, the banks knew that they would be essentially socialized if they had any losses. So if you look at Greece's debt ratio to GDP, yeah, it was pretty high as of 2001 when they entered the euro. It was about 100%. But by 2007, it was 175%. So in 6 years, they basically, most of these loans from, let's say, German banks, for example, they went to finance the German submarine sales to the Greek Navy, fighter planes. The Greek Olympic Stadium, 2004, was built by Hochtief. It's a German construction company. And then when the financial crisis hit, Greece had run up all this debt to these private banks abroad. The banks got bailed out by the IMF, the ECB, and the Eurogroup's various lending programs. And they got bailed out twice. Both times, 90% of the debt relief didn't go to Greece. It went to these banks.
And in fact, the deals that have been supposedly negotiated with Greece aren't really bailouts at all. They're more a series of loans that even the IMF recognises they can't repay. And I say even the IMF because they don't have a great history in debt management. James Henry again.
If you can look at the targets that the IMF set for this, as the experts on this stuff, for how fast the austerity program that they imposed on Greece would work. In 2010, they issued one set of projections which showed a hockey stick kind of turnaround. 2012, they issued another set of projections, another hockey stick. The first hockey stick was wrong. The second hockey stick was wrong. The most recent hockey stick has already been falsified. 2 weeks ago, the IMF issued another forecast of austerity, in which the first time they basically said, yeah, actually, Greece really does need substantial debt relief. They still didn't talk about a haircut for the nominal amount of debt outstanding, but they talked about extending the terms to up to 40 years and lowering the interest rates. So Greece would still be in this situation, kind of trying to repay. By the time the young people who are now unemployed in Greece are 65 and unable to retire, maybe Greece will begin to recover from this horrific bloodletting.
So now the IMF has done the sums yet again. They're agreeing with what any 10-year-old child could have told you, that Greece just can't pay, and that it'll need a repayment holiday of 30 years as well as a substantial write-off of some of the debt. So after all that, they're admitting their austerity medicine hasn't worked, and, horror of horrors, that creditors might have to take a hit. And on the part of the Eurozone leaders and creditors, there are so many layers of hypocrisy, I just haven't got time to look at them all. But one of the negotiators, the Dutch finance minister, is a pretty good place to start.
I expect from them that they will work with us to strengthen the Greek economy, which is crucial, of course. We fully understand that a lot of work has to be done, and we stand ready to support them. Of course, membership of the Eurozone also means that you comply to all that we have agreed with each other. But on that basis, we stand ready to work with them.
He sounds so reasonable, doesn't he? But at the same time, this guy spends his time talking about working with Greece. His own nation, the pariah state of the Netherlands, is helping Greek multinationals avoid millions in taxes in Greece. And other European countries are up to no good too. When it comes to Greek wealth stashed away offshore, it's impossible to know just how much that really is, because the ownership of cash and assets are structured in such a way as to not be technically owned by Greeks. So a lot of it just doesn't get included in the estimates based on the so-called available data. But Greek black money in Swiss banks alone could be as much as 200 billion euros. As usual with these offshore centres, there's been next to no cooperation with Greece from places like Switzerland or Cyprus or Malta. And there's a limit as well to what Greece can do about raising more revenue from tax reform. Greece is estimated to miss out on around 28 billion euros a year, and it could well be much more. From the moment the Syriza government was elected, they hoped to bring in 3 billion euros extra by forcing big Greek companies to pay tax in Greece. They've raised their corporate tax rate to 29%. But how do they intend to enforce that when, as TaxCast listeners know, even the United States struggles to collect fair taxes because of the global corporate tax system? And the battle over the demand that Greece privatise its most valuable public assets tells you a lot about the whole negotiation process. James Henry.
In the privatisation programme, originally, German Finance Minister Schäuble had proposed that they turn over 50 billion of state assets to this Institute for Growth in Luxembourg, which he's the chairman of. It's half owned by KfW, which was the bank that in 2008 actually was called the dumbest bank in Europe because they paid Lehman 420 million euros just as Lehman was going under. So that was the outfit that was going to be administering the Greek privatization plan, according to Schäuble. But apparently now the Greeks get to set up their own independent trust fund. German finance minister is a lawyer. He's a tax attorney, a lifelong Christian democratic politician. I mean, he was very close to Helmut Kohl. He was involved in receiving bribe money, 100,000 Deutschmark payment in 1994 from a German arms dealer who lived in Canada to facilitate a tank sale by Tyson to Saudi Arabia. He was then kind of blackballed out of the party for a while, then came back and was rehabilitated by Merkel after she took office.
Greece's experience of predatory and incompetent privatization is typical of what happened in debt-ridden countries in Asia, Latin America and Africa in past years. But whatever Greeks might feel about their Syriza government now, Syriza did have strong public support of a kind that political parties of other nations can only dream of. And the referendum, where Greeks clearly voted no to more austerity measures, was really clear. Vasilis Fouskas again.
The Greeks did the right thing. They've done the referendum. They were very brave, despite the massive blackmail by European officials, the private media, everybody. And the Greeks voted against all those people. This is a massive achievement. People don't say that. The amount of scaremongering and propaganda in favor of the yes vote, it was amazing. I momentarily thought that the yes camp will win. I mean, look what's going on. And then people silently, with pride, went and voted 61%. They said, no, it's enough is enough. You know, you're very powerful if you have nothing to lose. You're very powerful if you're very rich, and you're also very powerful if you have nothing to lose, but nothing.
James Henry again.
Basically, it's not economics that's driving the story, it's politics. You know, they didn't want Syriza to come off as a winner here, a left party in Greece. If you take a look at these other players, the Finns, for example, they just have a newly elected government as of April. One of the key parties that has the foreign ministry now in Finland is called the True Finns Party. They are a right-wing, anti-EU. They have all these extreme statements about black people and Muslims and sterilizing immigrants who are black who come to Finland on their website. And it's now called the Finns Party. But they threatened that if there was any debt relief for Greece, they would resign from the Finnish government and cause a new election. So this isn't just about Greek politics. There are right-wing parties growing all over Northern Europe. Poland just had an election in which the right-wing party had a surprising increase in its voice. The Danes had an election where the right party was rising. We're just going to have elections in France where Le Pen is threatening. You know, Hungary has moved to the right quite far. And then you have these tiny countries like Estonia and Slovenia and Slovakia. It's just, calling the shots here. So it's not just Germany. It's this whole kind of Nordic crowd that doesn't believe that Greece deserves any assistance whatsoever, and furthermore is diametrically opposed to its politics.
Politics aside, reforming Greece's tax system involves first the political will to take on the powerful interests in the country who, going right back to dictatorship days, have no intention of paying any tax. And secondly, reforming the tax system in Greece under current austerity conditions seems like an impossible challenge. Vasilis Fouskas.
Yes, you have to reform the tax system. You have to see what you can do in practice. With the kind of apparatus you have, because the Greek state machine is not working, is totally dilapidated, inefficient, not even properly modernized. You go to many tax offices in Greece and you see papers and envelopes and files one over the other. It hasn't been proper computerization. They've done a lot of work, don't take me wrong. There is this so-called tax system which they improved, but honestly, the tax branches all around Greece are very difficult to work because of the cuts. For example, the place I come from, Lesbos, the prefecture of Lesbos includes three islands. The island of Lesbos is very big, is the third biggest island in Greece. A smaller island, which is called Limnos, and an even smaller one, which is called Agios Astratios. believe it or not, there is one tax office serving these three islands. Now, a man of 60-year-old who never used a computer, he takes the boat, go to the tax office in Mytilene, which is the capital of Lesbos, and waits in the queue. And then when he comes to see the civil servant says, you brought the wrong paper, you have to go back. Now, this is appalling. That's why the previous governments failed. That's why austerity and neoliberalism will fail. Greece is a very peculiar country. It has 2,000 islands. Every island must have a doctor, must have a school, must have a nursery, must have hospitals. This requires an enlarged public sector. Now, neoliberalism comes and says, sack them all in order to have budget surpluses. I think this is obscene and completely unrealistic.
So, I mean, if that's the case for a 60-year-old man who lives on one of the Greek islands, how do they manage with multinational corporations?
Well, this is a good question. They manage by not managing, because the multinational corporations don't pay taxes. So, therefore, that's why you need a strong state. It's a myth that the state should disappear. You cannot do without the state. The state, as a regulator of the market, that supports aggregate demand, not the state as a producer of nationalism. It's wrong to see the state as a producer of nationalism in Europe. This idea has to go away. You must see the state as an economic and political manager that has a strong presence in the economy in favor of the weak. Greece's debt is unsustainable. The Greeks cannot pay that debt. I mean, let me put it in a very simple way. You lend on an interest rate which is something like 3-4% at the time when the country has a contraction of 5%, and you ask them to pay the debt, and you put them in an austerity program, starve them all, sack them all, no job, you won't find the money with the primary surpluses that they have. This logic of primary surpluses is completely surreal. I mean, the first-year student in economics will tell you this. Why are they doing it? Because of the rigidity and the dogmas prevailing within the bankers in the European Monetary Union. It is as simple as that. You sit down to negotiate, and all they have, they give you a piece of papers with numbers and statistics. That's all they know. They don't care about the conditions in the country. They don't care about people. They don't care about macroeconomic data you bring them. They don't care about all these things. All they want is to get every month, every other month, to get money back. But they can get the money back only if they lend more money. So Greece basically cannot even catch up with the interest rates. It's usury what's happening. It's total usury.
James Henry.
This isn't unique to Greece. You know, if the IMF ever looked back in time and did a autopsy, they rarely do. They would find that, you know, there are all these bodies lying around. I mean, Argentina won't even have anything to do with the IMF. Korea, 1999, Indonesia, 1998, Brazil. I mean, the list just goes on and on. What they've accumulated is a long list of countries that will not have anything to do with the IMF ever again. And so except for Greece, which is kind of this exception, the IMF is kind of like now reduced to consulting to Guinea, Barbados, Haiti.
It's all the more ironic then, Jim, isn't it, now that it seems to be the IMF that's the one throwing Greece a lifeline, you know, by pushing the Eurozone to consider this 30-year debt repayment holiday and the partial debt write-off.
You can't tell me that, yeah, I mean, there's the Finns and there's the Estonians and there's the Latvians and the Dutch. But you can't tell me that if Germany actually was willing to make debt relief happen, even given all the technical rules and so forth, they couldn't find some exception. What are we talking about, really? 80 billion euros, I mean, 100 billion euros. This is a rounding error for a German finance minister, really. I mean, they bailed out one of the largest banks in Germany, received 102 billion euro bailout during the financial crisis. Greece is less important than a state-owned German bank that made some lousy loans. I mean, This is going to poison relations in Europe for decades.
Professor Fuskas.
I believe that the European project lost a lot of its positive image it used to have, because it was dressed with beautiful things that we're all Europeans, we all have the same currency, and we're all rich and prosperous, and the weak economies converge towards the center. Instead, what we're witnessing is that the economies converge towards the periphery. Greece converges towards the bottom, towards Bosnia and Bulgaria. Does not converge with Germany. Same happens with Portugal, Spain, and a great part of Italy. The Italian southerner becomes even more economically depressed and peripheral rather than it used to be under the Italian state when they had the Italian lira. I hope they will find an agreement, and I want them to find an agreement that includes cancellation of large part of the debt and a clause, a developmental clause, investment to go to infrastructural projects and to industry. This is what I want to see happening. If there is no light at the end of the tunnel, then the preferred option is to default and exit the Eurozone. I see no other alternative.
Professor Vasilis Fuskas co-authored a book called Greece, Financialization and the EU, the Political Economy of Debt and Destruction. You'll find the link on the Tax Justice Network website. And that's it for this month. You've been listening to the Tax Justice Network's monthly podcast. We'll be back next month.